Hello and welcome to the main reader on Main Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was reviewing the history of the American lawn. We resume Suburban Safari on page 108, and this is episode 11. As a nation, the United States spends upward of $45 billion a year on turf care. That's nearly half the gross national product of Ireland, spent on grass. And the dollars don't account for hours we spend babying the finicky plants, or the polluting gasoline we pour into the lawnmower, or the polluting chemicals we pour on the grass. The evils of weed killers and insecticides are real and numerous, and frankly so well documented that I find it tiresome to repeat the bad news. Everybody knows our cultural fascination with grass farming flits beyond the bounds of logic, but we do it anyway. We each have our reasons, and some of those reasons are even rational. My own reason is currently undergoing a major rethink. When I began studying my yard, my knee-jerk opinion was that the lawn was a waste of space that could be better spent on shrubs to shelter wildlife. Then I got to know my insects and realized that they feed the birds and mammals I'm so fond of. And insects, I discovered, think of my lawn as their beautiful prairie. So I was pleased to learn that the Freedom Lawn I currently maintain is a giant step towards sustainable lawn culture. The Freedom Lawn was invented, so to speak, by three scholars at Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, who argue the merits of weeds in redesigning the American lawn. Their description fits my patchwork lawn perfectly. Who knew I was a trendsetter in landscape design? Poking around the internet, I find that the Freedom Lawn is becoming more and more common. Lawn owners who lack the necessary weeds to start a Freedom Lawn are ordering eco-turf mixes of stuff like clovers, wild daisies, chamomile, yarrow, rye, fescue, and baby blue eyes. Some mixes combine flowering greens, while others feature herbs. Chamomile, one source advertises, perfumes the air with the scent of pineapple whenever you step on it. Some mixes are meant to be mowed only once a month. The Freedom Lawn is becoming a movement. In Milford, Connecticut, residents now compete for an annual Freedom Lawn Prize. The Garden Club of America, citing cancer rates, pollution, and water shortages, is promoting something called the New American Lawn, which sounds exactly like a Freedom Lawn. Remember that Mother Nature abhors a monoculture, the Garden Club brochure exhorts. It goes on to urge a cold turkey approach to pesticides and patience while the soil recovers from systematic poisoning. Even those who cannot learn how to love dandelions can participate in the Freedom Lawn Revolution. My friend Mark, an ardent environmentalist, cannot abide dandelions in his city lawn. But with two kids rolling in the grass, he can't abide toxic herbicides either. Corn gluten meal, he tells me, with a grass farmer's zeal gleaming in his eye. And from what I read, it sounds natural to the point of being edible. If you spread it in the spring before your clover, dandelions, and crabgrass germinate, it messes up their roots. I have so little grass that if I corn-glutened my clover and dandelions, I'd have no lawn left. But to each his own. In my case, the Freedom Lawn movement is really a lack of movement. Before I was enlightened, I did feel a pinch of guilt whenever I skipped a week of mowing and things got flowery. Now I don't mow more than twice a month, and I'm going to let a patch go completely feral to see what happens. That, then, is the complete history of the American lawn. We've gone from pasture to grass farm, and now back to pasture again. Anyone curious about how weeds might suit their house can check out the Freedom Lawn at the White House. On a field trip far from my own 2/10 of an acre, I found that the nation's capital has gone feral. Clover and dandelions, Canadian dwarf cinquefoil, and white-flowered chickweed tinkle up at me and the tourists who are peeking through the wrought iron fence. I even see mushrooms. Biodiversity is running rampant. This is not what I expected. I'm showing myself around the Capitol while I wait to meet the fellow responsible for all the weeds. I'm poking under leaves, counting ants, and squinting into bushes to spot birds. Here's a funny thing about urban ecology. Whenever I stop to inspect my surroundings, people gather. They follow my stare, and they see things too. Evidently, they see things that are remarkable to them. "Look, Bob, it's a bird," says wife to husband. "Hey, it's eating something." When I stop at the wrought iron fence on the north lawn of the White House, my gaze draws the attention of a squirrel. The squirrel hops over and sniffs me for handouts. He's disappointed, but lo, a small boy spots him and guides his family over. The squirrel scans the family for food. Now the squirrel is out in the open, and more people stop to watch him. He hops onto the sidewalk. Two men with Indian accents crouch, and one holds out a banana. The squirrel rises to clasp the fruit and gobbles. Seven people gather. Four take pictures of the man feeding the squirrel. A tall man in mirrored sunglasses, talking on a cell phone, stops to relay a play-by-play of the event into the telephone. More people slow down to watch. Strangers talk together about the squirrel, until the approach of yelling Iranian protesters scares the rodent, a bubble of squirrel love claims the sidewalk. The lawn to which the squirrel returns is begloomed with trees. Someone has raked the day's fallen leaves and twigs into a small pile. Half a dozen squirrels, one of them missing half a tail, nudge through the grass and weeds. That's a lot of squirrels in a small space. I'm reminded of a watershed moment in White House lawn history. Nixon was in office and the rat population was exploding. The Interior Department distributed rat poison, but this incensed an unexpected constituency. Squirrel lovers rose up in outrage. Nixon's press secretary, confronted by a journalist with the possibility that the wrong rodent could be poisoned, considered the problem and made a policy announcement. We're against the rats. We're for the squirrels. This protectionist position persisted. Ronald Reagan was passionately for squirrels. He brought them bags of acorns from Camp David. Other visitors to Capitol Parks fed them, too. If your tail was bushy, life was good. The nearby Lafayette Park, scientists announced in 1981, hosted the greatest number of squirrels per millimeter of any place in the cosmos. Although a gentle anti-feeding campaign has trimmed the population, squirrels are still doing just ducky. Here on the back lawn of the White House, I see the first geriatric squirrel of my career, a beast so coddled it has grown gray and creaky. Circling to the front of the White House, I spot a large raptor, perhaps a red-tailed hawk, high over the mall. That has to be good news. It suggests that there's enough nature in town to feed a family of large predators. You wouldn't know it from where I'm standing. A few songbirds hide in the trees, but I've seen only a single crow and a handful of pigeons. I proceed to the Smithsonian Castle, where Jim Sherrill, pacing the stone-dust path, is easy to spot. He's tall, and he's the only man on the mile-long mall who's wearing shiny black shoes. Everyone else is in jogging shoes, football-tossing shoes, frisbee-catching shoes, pram-pushing shoes, or 10 museums in a day shoes. It's nearly raining, but not quite. A stone's throw down the mall, planners of an upcoming festival have dumped truckloads of dirt next to their tent, killing many square yards of the nation's grass. "It looks like they're creating a new landscape," says the man, who strives to maintain the original landscape. "A landscape with hills." Sherald, chief of natural resources and science for the Park Service's Capital Region, has done a lot of evolving in his years. Years ago, he felt it might be best if people kept their deadly little feet entirely off the mall's struggling grass. Now he can shrug off the invasion of entire hills. And back when he started at the Park Service, the agency observed a regular schedule of fogging the nation's front lawn with pesticides and herbicides. Now the mall is weedy. A dandelion spreads its leaves at the end of Jim's shiny shoe. Beneath the turf is a soil whose troubles are legion. Never mind today's imposition of mini-mountains. This soil has supported million-man marches. It has shuddered beneath horse races and a railway line. Civil War encampments have come and gone. The soils are compacted to the point of concrete, Jim says, literally, and they're not native soils to start with. The native soil lies about 20 feet down. It's swamp muck. Filling began in the mid-1800s. The 20 feet of added earth is consistent only in its randomness. You sample here, and then go a few feet away, and the two are drastically different, Jim says. A 1986 study of the mall described in precise scientific language a soil composed of building rubble and random loads of dirt. That even a dandelion can grow here seems noteworthy. I poke it with my toe. Is that an abomination in your eyes? I ask. Jim looks down. It used to be. But, he explains in a faded southern accent, the whole Park Service has evolved. There was a time when we had a treatment schedule. We treated just about everything. But the age of going up and down this mall with a sprayer... He casts a theatrical eye at the masses of joggers, frisbeers, baby strollers, and tourists busily breathing air. We don't do that anymore. The chemical tide turned in the 1970s with an increase in public awareness of the dangers. The Park Service questioned its own dependence on pesticides. We started backing things out, and the world didn't fall apart. Jim chuckles. In fact, the other day I was checking cherry trees for peach scale bugs, and I couldn't find any. I think when we were spraying, we were killing a lot of beneficial insects that now keep things under control. So perhaps less spraying begets even less spraying. The 600 elm trees that edge the mall require some medical care to hold off Dutch elm disease, but they're medicated only when they show signs of illness, and their chem-free green crowns may represent the biodiversity hotspot on the mall, Jim says. We've done sticky card surveys in the canopy to gauge the insect activity. We found a surprisingly large diversity of life in the crowns. That was a revelation to me. This mall is supporting far more diversity than you'd suspect. But it's not until you start looking that you see it. As for the diversity of larger creatures, Jim inclines his head in the direction of a European starling prospecting in the grass. You're looking at it. Crows, he says, used to be more numerous before the West Nile virus came. The occasional deer wanders onto the mall, causing migraines for management. I, in a few hours of rambling, spotted mockingbirds and grackles and a few other birds, but that's about all. However, the usual coterie of larger creatures is easing closer and closer to town. Black bears, coyotes, and Canada geese are making pests of themselves nearby, and beavers once again have their eye on the cherry trees ringing the tidal basin. The day a coyote slips through the wrought iron fence to nip the tail of a White House squirrel might be the day we're due for an updated policy on whom we're for and whom we're against. In all my capital perambulations, the only perfect lawn I can find lies in front of the National Sculpture Gallery. Not a weed raises its head. Each grass blade is as wide as its neighbor, and each is snipped off square. Still, something's going right. Three grackle youngsters beg and flutter in the grass, which means that insects are plentiful enough to grow birds. And a pair of mockingbirds are sitting on a red calder sculpture. They pinwheeled toward the grackle parents each time one comes to feed the children. They, too, probably have youngsters nearby. It's all pleasantly surprising. I came here expecting to find the nation's front lawn sterilized and embalmed in pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers. Instead, I find it leading the way out of chemical dependency. Cheeky finds me on the deck and explores me from head to toe, looking for seeds. I fetch him a cupful, and he shuttles them away. The panting crows ignore him when he pops out of the ground and darts into the shrubs, keeping cover as he returns to the deck. Cheeky has grown a size since I met him, and his tail is bushy. He carries more than 38 seeds per cheek now, I think. When the heat of midday finally passes and Cheeky has retreated to his tunnels, I put my nose to the ground and start my crawl across the lawn. I settle first in the bottleneck between the choke cherry tree and the lilac hedge. It's Clover City. The clover leaves overlap, blotting every photon of sunlight. Beneath this closed canopy, nary a soul stirs. The ground is warm and hardened by drought. In the square foot I've chosen, not a stem of grass or yarrow, dandelion or sorrel, breaks the pattern of round leaves and white flowers. Wait, what's this fuzzy character? I open my wildflower guide. The interloper has canoe-shaped leaves with long hairs on them and skinny flower stalks, atop which strange hairy buds wave. Mouse-ear hawkweed. Dear me, what I have on my hands is a floral face-off. These two plants do not care for each other, and they're duking it out. Despite the benefits of diversity, a plant won't let any old weed sidle into its territory. Clover, an old English name for an old English plant, likes to live with clover. Hawkweed, the old English thought hawks ate it to maintain their eyesight, prefers the company of hawkweed. So, just as pines acidify the soil on which they sprout, so do hawkweeds. At least, that's how it looks to scientists early in their inquiry. The soil directly below a patch of hawkweed is more acidic than the surrounding soil. The acid, in turn, boosts the level of soluble aluminum. Aluminum is toxic to clover and to many other plants, insects, and microbes. That's why scientists study hawkweed. With its pioneering spirit, it's elbowing the forage grasses out of valuable pasture land. But my clover's not ready to roll over. Every plant excretes chemicals into the soil around its roots, and those chemicals encourage a particular suite of microbes. The activity of the microbes alters the soil to the plant's liking. Clover also nourishes bacteria inside its roots, and in exchange, those bacteria convert atmospheric nitrogen to fertilizer for their host. The clover army is well supplied and standing its ground. Plant warfare is as old as the hills. In a world with limited soil surface, it's eat or be eaten, shade or be shaded. The Norway maple spreads a mesh of roots just below the surface to catch water before it trickles down. The dandelion counters by opening a rosette of leaves that catch the flower before it hits the ground, funneling it toward a taproot. And here, at the entrance to my lawn, clover and hawkweed spar with each other underground. From the clover patch, I crawl into a savanna. The spot is less shaded and more parched. About 80% of it is covered with grass and just one species. Mixed in is a smattering of yellow wood sorrel, one hawkweed, and a few of what I think of as ten petal. It has teensy white flowers. I thought bird books were a headache. Flower books are a cluster headache. In this semi-arid ecosystem, I can look down through the vegetation to the pale dirt. I see a pile of castings, the digested soil expelled from a worm's back end. I spy a bird turd. Ants of two species roam across the savanna. A dandelion parachute has tangled in the grass, and the seed is working its way toward the dirt. The grass blades are ragged at the top. Dry fibers emerge like bones from green flesh. From a botanist's viewpoint, trimming vegetation with a mower blade must evoke the era of performing surgery with a hammer and saw. The leaves are literally clubbed in two. Oddly enough, this works to the advantage of the planet, if not the plant. Turf mavens once thought mutilated grass like mine sucked up far more water than grass cut with a surgically sharp mower blade. The torn flesh, they believed, gushed water. But a mowing trial by University of Nebraska grass scientists reaches a freedom lawn-friendly conclusion. They find that grass bashed with a dull blade requires one-third less water than clean-snipped grass. Their best guess is that abused grass grows more slowly. But wait, nothing's clear-cut with energy and ecology. The scientists argue that we ought to keep the blades sharp anyway, because it reduces the mower's fuel use by 22%. Maybe the question is which resource we want to save the most. If it's energy, then we should be encouraging grass to leak more water, not less. Grass, like most plants, cools itself and the air around it by releasing moisture. Measuring the effectiveness of this trick is as easy as stepping barefoot from the lawn to the street on a hot day. A 30-degree difference isn't uncommon. The contrast is strongest after sunset, when the grass cools quickly, but the street throbs late into the night. All this cooling around the house reduces the amount of air conditioning we need indoors. Grass is even better than trees at the evaporative cooling business. Trees win overall because their shade prevents sunlight from soaking the city in the first place. So to save cooling energy, the more water grass consumes after a good haircut, the better. Furthermore, if I mangle my grass, I may damage its ability to make clean air. Like other plants, grass inhales CO2 and exhales oxygen. Slow-growing, sickly grass doesn't do that as quickly. In truth, how effectively even healthy grass produces oxygen is a contentious subject. The Turf Resource Center, an industry group, says a lawn 50 feet square produces enough oxygen to sustain a family of four. Impressive. Baloney, argue the authors of Redesigning the American Lawn. The lawn consumes oxygen in any number of ways. Bacteria that digest grass clippings gulp oxygen, as does the gas-burning lawnmower. Manufacturing and shipping fertilizer burns more, as does pumping water. The average lawn, they say, is an oxygen and energy hog. Debatable as well is how well lawns purify water. Experiments at a well-managed golf course have shown that polluted water running off a highway can benefit from flowing through clean, healthy turf. The grass slows the water enough that it sinks in. The aerated soil holds it. Microorganisms in the soil break down some of the pollutants. The water that comes out the other side is much improved. But if the lawn is not well managed, it becomes a source, not a sink, for pollutants. Water isn't going to benefit from flowing across a lawn freshly sprinkled with fertilizer or grub killer. It's not going to improve itself by gathering dog manure or herbicides from a backyard. If a lawn is compacted or sloped, little water will sink in at all. The same dichotomy afflicts a lawn's air filtering potential. A lawn can trap lots of blowing dust and pollen. When I pluck a tuft of grass and clover to put under the microscope, I see that for myself. At high magnification, the leaves are spotted with hunks of quartz and flecks of mica, scraps of dead vegetation, and yellow blobs of pollen. But whether a neighbor's lawn is a friend of clean air when she's blazing at dandelions with a bottle of herbicide, I doubt it. Whether my lawn represents a net gain for air quality when the low-performance engine of my lawnmower is burping soot? Not likely. Maybe the lawn's least debatable benefit is its recreational value. In my travels and interviews, I find that even those scientists most familiar with the evils of the American lawn tend to have one. "My boy likes to play football," says one guy. Another says with a shrug, "I have to kick the soccer ball around with my kids, so I have to have grass. Then I have to put nitrogen on my lawn because it keeps the weeds out. If my lawn looks bad, my neighbors are going to be unhappy." And I admit, I'd miss my own swath of the outdoor carpet. Sometimes I think I could live with no lawn at all, just paths between native shrubs. But just today, with a visiting dog, I sprinted barefoot across the yard. The Freedom Lawn was cool and sticky, and a shade of green that always reminds me of the Emerald City. It smelled green and warm, and exactly like summer. The most surprising ecosystem service I discover in my lawn is its ability to combat global warming. Remember the notion that planting a tree will soak up some of the carbon dioxide we release to the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels? Well, there's just a whiff of evidence that planting the right kind of lawn could remove even more carbon from the air, acre for acre. Studies of the amount of carbon stored in the soil beneath various ecosystems, farm fields, grasslands, pasture, forests, and shrublands, usually reach the same conclusion. The pastures and grasslands sock away the most carbon. Letting woody shrubs take over a field is a carbon loser. Conversely, letting grasslands take over a farm field is a big winner. Now, grassland and pasture aren't exactly synonymous with lawn. They're especially non-synonymous with an all-grass lawn because grasslands and pastures tend to support a diversity of plants and their sods are deep and porous. But I'm encouraged that my Freedom Lawn might be related to this carbon-storing clan of landscapes. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.